Taking Stock with Vincent Wall. This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk with me, Vincent Wall. This is where we take a wider view of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. We're joined now by Andrew Zolli. He's the Vice President of Global Impact at Planet, a space and artificial intelligence-driven organisation, and he's the author of Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. Andrew, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here with you.
Now, apart from your interests and indeed your activities in tech, in artificial intelligence and in space to try to improve all our futures, and we discuss some of those issues in just a few moments, I hope, your key field of interest and expertise is the area of resilience and risk and how systems, economies or societies can bounce back from threat or challenge. A lot of people will argue that planet Earth is probably in one of its riskiest positions ever now. Before we go any further, how do you assess the scale of the crisis and its potential impact?
Well, you know, it's such a great question, Vincent. You know, we like to use outsized metaphors when describing large events. So people will tell you that this event is a seismic event in history. And they're right. It's not only metaphorically a seismic event, it's a literal seismic event. The seismologists around the world, from China to New York to Dublin to Italy, can literally measure the quieting of the planet as human beings have stilled ourselves upon its surface. So the normal rumble of trains and planes and automobiles of human habitation have dimmed across the planet. And it's hard to wrap our heads around an event of that scale and magnitude. It's certainly the largest disruptive event of our lifetimes, without question.
And we might come to some of the longer term impacts in just a few moments, Andrew, but as with many of the states in the United States where you're currently based, we here in Ireland and across Europe are slowly trying to reopen our economy, as we must do to get people back into employment and generating their own incomes again. But as many people have remarked, the opening up could prove to be more problematic than the shutting down. How do you assess this risk? You've been writing about so-called risk homeostasis. Can you tell us a bit more about that and how it might apply to trying to open up again through COVID-19?
Well, let's start with the begin. Before we turn to risk homeostasis, I'll just say a word or two just about the complexities of opening up and shutting down. That the challenge that we have right now is first one of uncertainty. And human beings loathe uncertainty. We react to it as spiders crawling on our skin. The challenge in this environment is that we are going to need very flexible and dynamic kinds of policies. We may need to open up in some places and not others, certain parts of industry and not others. We may need to be careful and change in time so that we do something, you know, in December and another thing in January and another thing yet again in February. And that's very hard for people to plan around. And so, unfortunately, it's our own appetite or lack of appetite for complexity and ambiguity that often limits our choices. Another aspect of this that we have to contend with is something you mentioned, risk homeostasis, which is a very interesting concept. It was first identified by a number of psychologists and people who study risk. And it posits that all human beings, all individuals, you and me, and everyone who's listening to this program today, have a kind of innate level of risk, appetite for risk, so that we feel comfortable taking a certain amount of risk in our lives. And you can sort of think about it like water going through a sluice gate. If the water is blocked from one channel, it will find a way to another channel. That human beings, if blocked from expressing their natural appetite for risk in one area, will start to take it in another. So, for example, paradoxically, in places where bicycle helmets have been mandated, in places where there's a lot of bicycle riding, including places like Dublin, what you find is that drivers will drive faster and closer to marked bike lanes when bicyclists are required to wear helmets because they presume that the cyclists are safer than they actually are. And so they adjust their behavior not to drive as slowly next to the bicyclists as they would like to. There's a famous rule, it's called Bill Booth's rule number 2 in skydiving, which says that the safer that skydiving equipment becomes, the more risks skydivers will take in order to keep the fatality rate constant, because that's the job of skydivers is to engage in risky behavior. That's the whole point of the exercise. So if it becomes safer, we do more dangerous things. Now think about this in the context of COVID for a moment. We've just blocked lots of people from engaging in normal behavior. And there is certainly, you know, lockdown fatigue. There's quarantine fatigue. People just get tired of being stuck indoors. But a bigger part of the story is that some people feel quite confident taking very substantial risks in their lives, and they'll advocate for taking those risks because they feel quite confident in themselves, but may not fully appreciate the collective risk that happens. And we see this particularly when it intersects with our other belief systems. And I say this as a person of great respect for communities of faith, for instance, who are feeling enormously driven to meet again. And the CDC here in the United States, as an example, recently pinpointed that during one choir practice, one single choir practice got 50 people sick and 2 people died when they went to choir practice to participate in their faith. And putting our appetite for risk and our belief systems about the world and some abstract form of risk in a stew and kind of mixing them together is a mix for very, I know it's a complicated mix in which we're going to make very different kinds of decisions. So it's hard to manage the psychology of how we respond as much as the policies of how we respond.
And given that very complex psychology that each of us has to a different degree, how can we at a governmental or societal level work out what is the proper balance of risk between trying to protect particularly the more vulnerable people in our society from this disease and the downsides of not getting back to normality, both economically, to the educational advancement of our children, to the mental health of a lot of people who have had to be lonely? How do leaders try to get that balance right?
You know, I don't envy any leader in the world today who has to balance those. What we've suddenly done is say we have to take the enormous complexity of human lived experience and the trade-offs associated with those experiences, and we have to balance them on the head of a pin. And by definition, you can't. It's an impossible formula to resolve with precision. I think there are certainly some important elements to getting it right. Having the right kind of respect for expertise, listening to public health experts to give us a sense of what the risks are, hearing from our constituencies and trying to understand what's the most efficient and effective path to keeping people safe while opening up our activities. Finding middle grounds. So, for example, one of the places that we're going to see, I think, much more of is what we think of today. We're engaged in a lot of social distancing, you know, keeping several meters apart from everyone around us. That's been the guidance. But I live in a household, for instance, with a half a dozen people. We're not socially distancing within our house because we're all related to each other. And when we go outside, we don't socially distance when we're outside because we're together. And we could see more of what we call clustered distancing, which is I follow a protocol, my neighbor follows the same protocol, and then we feel comfortable being together within that protocol as long as we have very, very strong evidence that we're mutually following the same level of risk adjustment procedures. So there are going to be techniques that we experiment with, but I think the important thing is, probably the most important thing, is an understanding of how our behavior relates to the whole and whether or not we belong to the whole, whether or not we are part of one community, one family, one body, one social body. And so, for instance, here in the United States, unfortunately, these policies have been interpreted through political lenses, so that suddenly, you know, it's Democrats or liberals or progressives who believe one thing in our country and conservatives who believe another thing in this country about these policies and about their distancing. And unfortunately, the virus has worked to sharpen our social distinctions rather than dissolve them into one sense of our being in one boat together, which we really are. So, you know, the first step for trying to make these impossible balancing test decisions is to make sure that everyone understands that we really are in the same boat and that we are woven together through webs of mutuality and shared destiny, ultimately, so that what happens to any of us will ultimately affect all of us. That feeling is the first test of leadership right now, and it's being passed in some places and not in others.
I was just going to pick up on that thread, because do you think that on top of all the other range of risks that we face, as you outlined, that on top of that, there's, I suppose, an increasing disparagement of expertise in certain quarters, and I'm afraid also by your president, which must influence certain constituencies. But also, perhaps as this goes on, the genuine feeling amongst people who do understand the wider public health risks and the risks to others, but their own economic risk will take precedence, particularly as government support measures begin to wane?
It's a profound question. I'll only speak momentarily to our situation here in the United States. Alas, if you could devise the antithesis of an effective strategy, you'd probably have what looks like what's happening at the federal level right now in terms of messaging and leadership. So we have the routine disparagement of expertise and the dismissal of science as a political constituency rather than as the best way of understanding the facts and things on the ground. We have a president who's not only, you know, he's endorsed unproven medications. He's told people that they should simply risk it. He's said that people who go out and cluster in place and violate the quarantines and avoid social distancing are warriors. And he's used the language of bravery and liberation to encourage people to go out and violate his own government's edicts and guidance policy. So unfortunately, what that's done is it's created a kind of every state for themselves policy where states and groups of states in our country have to band together at the local level, even at the kind of municipal level, to determine what makes sense for them in the absence of any coordinated policy. And it's led particularly egregiously to competition between some of the like local municipalities. You know, imagine if you had every city in Ireland competing for the same PPE, the same personal protective equipment and the medical equipment and ventilators and what have you. That's what we've had here. So unfortunately, it's been very challenging and very difficult to navigate and to develop coherent policy. More broadly, I think ultimately we are going to see the right kinds of strategies emerge sort of in spite of that rather than because of it. And so we have had examples, and I think here in the United States, we have had the governor of the state of New York, for instance, has been widely lauded for his daily press conferences where he goes out and speaks candidly, accurately, provides guidance, reduces complexity, speaks with compassion, personifies and individualizes, and in this case, his own brother, who is a well-known journalist in the United States, became sick with coronavirus. It had affected his family. He could sort of speak to that. And so we have had examples of how to do it right. And, you know, it's a measure of how well Governor Cuomo did that there are citizens around the country who don't live in New York, who aren't affected by his edicts, who would tune in just to listen to competence, just to listen to someone who seemed to know what they were talking about and who was deferential to expertise while still trying to develop policies, just to hear from a leader who seemed to be getting it right. Such is the appetite for competence more broadly in a society.
I suppose one of the offshoots of what we've all been going through, Andrew, is the debate as to how many of the changes that we've had to adapt to will just be short term, and how many will be longer term and deeply structural. And I suppose one of those is the whole use of technology, which we've all become more accustomed to in terms of broadcasting, in terms of our daily work, in terms of communicating. But also we have become fascinated by the impact of technology and science on trying to find a cure, amongst other things. Do you think this is a key point in the broad citizenry beginning to understand that technology can be a friend, or is that alienation from the purveyors of technology and those who control it still there?
Well, there isn't a single answer to that question, but here's a few points of perspective. You actually asked two questions there, which are worth parsing. One is, what are the things that have recently happened that are likely to stay with us? And then what's the role of technology in socially, and what's its sort of social standing in society? Well, let's back up even more for a moment, Vincent. Imagine metaphorically that society is driving a car and we found ourselves in a ditch. When you find yourself in a ditch, there's two possible paths out of the ditch. You can back yourself back up onto the road you were on, or you can try to press forward over, you know, sort of through the berm and into the next lane. There's a debate that's going to happen in society broadly about everything now. This is a once, not just once in a generational conversation. I think it's more than that. It's a civilizational scale set of questions about how society is organized, about how people are valued, about how energy is produced and how labor is expressed, how people are valued, and the degree to which we balance individual freedoms and collective freedoms. All of those questions are up for grabs, and technology will play a role in many, if not all of them. So to return to the ditch metaphor for a moment, you know, the argument that we'll have is not between, I think, left and right, as they have been historically thought about, between conservative and progressive, the words we would use in the United States to describe those arguments, but between sort of open and closed, between forward and backward. And it's important to say that when you're in the ditch, the rational response to want to back up out of the ditch and go back to the way things were is rational. That's a completely rational and to be respected perspective. It's also rational to say, no, we can't go back. That's the road we skidded off of in the first place. We have to go to the next road. And of course, the way you really get out of a ditch is you rock the car back and forth, forward and backward until you find your footing and go one way or the other. That discussion between forward and back, open and closed, is going to be with us not just now, but it's going to be with us for the next generation, because we are in now what you might call the long emergency. And I'll come to technology in a moment, but the first step there, really a series of four connected crises that are happening concurrently. The first one has a horizon of the next several years, and that's the public health emergency. The public health emergency may be fixed with medication, right? We may come up with a vaccine relatively soon, but even manufacturing and distributing it to the whole world is going to take years of work. So we're talking about the next 3+ years, coronavirus is going to be with us. The next horizon is the economic horizon. That's the next 5 years, at least, of digging ourselves out of this spectacular once-in-a-century economic crisis that we found ourselves in. There's real damage being done to the world's economies right now that you can't just bounce back from. We're going to have to do reparative work. And then there's the third crisis, which is the longer-term crisis, which is a crisis of governance. It's a crisis of politics. It's a crisis of intergenerational relationships, because much of what has been sacrificed right now are the possibilities for younger people, poorer people, people who are vulnerable. And we've got all the mix of authoritarianism and the kind of shift to populism that's been happening out there, that all of that has to be navigated over the next generation or so. And cutting through all of them is the climate crisis, is the crisis of the loss of nature, and the question of how do we bounce forward to a more sustainable world, no matter what elements of the past we carry forth with it. So the first thing to say is we have all these connected crises. we're going to have to work on all of them. This is a kind of all hands on deck moment for every society in the world to work on those things. But we can't just blindly jump into the future. We have to figure out how we create the right kinds of continuities to the past, connections to our values and our heritage and our rituals and the things that make us uniquely us. So there's a lot of negotiation in there and a lot of navigating this disruption. So now you've asked the great question about technology. And in that context, technology is going to play a role across all parts of this. There is hope that we will see a vaccine in the next 14 to 18 months in just in terms of success. There is actually some guarded optimism that we will see that happen. We then are going to have to figure out how to provide it to 8 billion people on the planet and may need to provide it again and again and again because it may not provide forever immunity. It may only provide seasonal immunity. This is the moonshot of all moonshots for humanity right now. Is that I guarantee you the people who develop the vaccine will win, you know, all the Nobel Prizes for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. The next question is really at the vanguard of the economic questions. It's the second crisis I mentioned. And there, the story with technology is more complicated because one of the things that's not widely appreciated is that in recessions, automation actually accelerates. In the last three recessions we had in the United States, 88% of the jobs that were found to be at risk and that were lost were all in parts of the labor market that were automatable. And one of the things that created persistent problems for our society was that we saw the middle of the labor market start to be eaten up by a combination of globalization and automation. And so the reality is some of these jobs won't come back. Some people have been laid off, not just temporarily, but permanently. It's just that we haven't determined that fact yet, because we're going to see a lot more, and I say this word very, you know, metaphorically, we're going to see a lot more robots in society. We're going to see a lot more algorithms and a lot more automation in many parts of the world. That doesn't mean there isn't a place for humans. There absolutely is. But we have to make conscientious decisions about the ways in which human beings, the way we think about labor and jobs and the way we think about the role of technology, instead of thinking about human labor as an expense to be eliminated through efficiency, perhaps technology is a cradle that is designed to unlock human flourishing and creative potential. You know, this matter of labor substitution, for instance, by technology is of such concern that, you know, Bill Gates said a year or two ago, you know, if a robot takes your job, perhaps a robot should pay your taxes, because there's a concern about the questions of economic fairness and the role of technology. You mentioned another one, which I'll just say a word to you about, which is about privacy. And here, again, there is a very complicated sociology. Younger people, by and large, don't have the same expectations of privacy that older people do. And these technologies may be ultimately too powerful an elixir for authoritarians to ignore in terms of their role in creating social surveillance, ongoing social surveillance, and ongoing use and potentially misuse. Now, those questions will all have to be negotiated. There's a big complex social negotiation to happen in all three of those places. So in some cases, the situation like around vaccines is going to be very, very powerful. In some cases around labor or around privacy, it may be much more negative. But there is this big set of conversations yet to come. And we shouldn't just assume that we can predict how they will happen. What we should say is that we need democratic processes to help us negotiate those choice points.
On that point, I mean, taking the wider macroeconomic viewpoint, Andrew, we see that I think five companies now equate to 20% of the value of the New York Stock Exchange. And we know who they are, the FANGs. And as we negotiate our way through this, those companies are becoming more and more profitable and more dominant. Those questions of how dominant can they be, how much can they intrude into our lives with consciously or not, and how they are governed are going to be big questions as well, aren't they?
Oh, indeed. The statistics that you cite, five companies now represent roughly 20% of the S&P 500. They are Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and Facebook. And they each, you know, they represent, there's good evidence that Jeff Bezos, for instance, just to put him in perspective, who is now the world's wealthiest man, worth well in excess of $100 billion, is well on his way to becoming the world's first trillionaire. And one of the challenges of technology that we see, and we see it manifested in this exact moment right now, is that disruptions tend to concentrate the and separate and concentrate the winners from the losers. So, for instance, there are many, many, many companies that are only marginally different from each other, where the differences are very narrow. And this process of the Great Depression 2.0 that we're beginning to live through now is going to winnow many of those and leave the winners to sort of receive the dividends of all of the losses of those other organizations that disappear. And so you're already seeing that happen now. What you're seeing is Amazon and Google and Apple are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're really creating distance between themselves and everybody else. In fact, if you look at the stock market generally, what you're really looking at is the performance of those companies making up for the losses of everybody else. The question then becomes, how do you regulate them in society? And what constitutes fairness? What constitutes a kind of grand social bargain between technology and society? And it's a bargain that involves more than just the role that they play in society. It also represents the question of what do we do about the concentrating effects of technology in terms of wealth inequality in society. And so there is some new grand bargain to be negotiated there, without question, whether it's, you know, treating these companies more as utilities, whether it's breaking them up, whether it's giving them a different kind of oversight and regulation. Many of the regulations that we use to govern them go back to the Great Depression of the 1930s. And before that, the things we used to bust the great trusts of the 1920s and earlier. And those tools may not be appropriate for the kind of contemporary enterprises that we have today. So there's no question that right now these companies are actually providing a lot of value to society, and they're actually working, many of them, on really substantial contributions to accelerating the way we'll deal with the COVID crisis. But on the other side, we're really going to have to deal with this fact that, unfortunately, one of the effects of technology is that it's concentrating the world into a very small cluster of winners and a very large community of people who are just barely, if at all, keeping their heads above water.
Which, of course, increases the risk, as you would put it, of further alienation and all the political and economic and social ramifications of that. Taking the broad tech spectrum, Andrew, one area where you're particularly interested is the whole question of artificial intelligence, which, of course, has been growing in our lives, whether we are aware of it or not, before the COVID crisis. A lot of artificial intelligence systems rely heavily on algorithms, as we know, and those algorithms either measure our activity, our patterns of behavior, or our predicted patterns of behavior. Of course, those predicted patterns of behavior have gone haywire over the last 3 months. Is this going to affect how artificial intelligence works, how algorithms works, or how algorithms are produced in the future?
It's a great question. And I think the short order answer is that COVID is going to fundamentally change artificial intelligence. In some ways, I hope to return it to some of its original promise. So let me unpack that for a moment. The first thing to say is that AI, as it's currently understood, there's no entity on Earth, artificial or human, that really understands the brain. I mean, really fundamentally understands what's going on. It's important to remember that our own understanding of what is intelligence is so deeply enigmatic and incomplete. What we know is dwarfed by what we think we know but cannot prove, and what we fundamentally don't know still about how we ourselves work. So when we say artificial intelligence, much of what we're talking about is really very supercharged pattern recognition. And much of what we do on a day-to-day basis is pattern recognition, so it seems quite intelligent. But here's an important point about that. as soon as artificial intelligence algorithms start doing anything, human beings tend to poo-poo whatever that thing is as no longer being intelligent. And the best example I can give you of that is that some of your listeners will certainly have heard, you know, when they call up to speak to customer service and they get a computer voice assisted system that says, "Hi, you know, I'm here to help you. Just tell me in a few words what you're looking for." And it does some speech to text translation and determines what you're looking for. Well, when that technology was invented, everyone said, "Oh, look, artificial people are here. I can talk to one on the telephone." Of course, it took for all of 5 minutes for us to realize just how brittle, fragile, and kind of unconvincing and unsatisfying many of those systems can be. If anyone has been stuck in, you know, phone help center hell talking to an algorithm, they know what that's like. So those algorithms tend to be defined very narrowly. Their definition of intelligence is very narrow. And so one of the challenges we have with really what artificial intelligence, to use another analyst term, I think is often misunderstood for what is really artificial single-mindedness. And that single-mindedness has been programmed into all of our lives in all kinds of unobvious ways, but they're all defined by what we consider to be normal behavior. So, for example, the team at Amazon has an algorithm, and if you happen to buy, oh, toilet paper, let's say once a month, and have it delivered via Amazon, they'll set up an algorithm which can predict that next month you probably need some toilet paper, until there's suddenly a crisis and our buying habits go absolutely haywire and people start hoarding toilet paper, which I don't know if they did this in Ireland, but they certainly did this here in the United States.
We did.
Yeah. People are building igloos out of, you know, unused toilet paper and these giant, you know, structures. And of course, it sends all the algorithms that are predicated on our kind of quote unquote normal behavior haywire. But there is a deeper lesson in this, which is that what algorithms think is normal and what actually represents the real range of quote unquote normal human behavior. Normal human behavior is so much wider than our algorithms infer. You know, if you're a rich person, if you're a poor person, if you're a person from a particular ethnic or cultural background, if you live in a particular part of the world and not another, your patterns are very different from each other, and they're all normal. And one of the challenges we have is that we end up with algorithms whose definitions are so narrow that they end up being profoundly biased against people whose definitions of normal are outside of the algorithm's definition of normal. And that bias has profound consequences. It keeps people from getting job offers because they don't see the jobs in the first place because the algorithm doesn't think that person should see that job offering, or they lose the opportunity to get a house or to participate in some form of society or another. And so the COVID crisis has scrambled the algorithms and scrambled the definition of normal. And they represent now, therefore, a moment when we can rebuild those algorithms to be more inclusive and to be more nuanced and more sophisticated of the fuller range of human experience, not just the late, you know, the period, because the people who built these algorithms, you know, many of them live in San Francisco or the Bay Area. They live in Silicon Valley. You know, they represent white, upper middle class, college educated, young people who's, you know, built them in their first job out of college between the years of 2015 and 2020. They represent the narrowest definition of what human experience could be. It's all one way. Now, perhaps we can build an AI that's truly not just more inclusive, but more useful.
We could talk all week about the really big challenge facing humanity, Andrew, the whole issue of climate change and carbon emissions. And I assume you haven't got all week to talk to us, although we really value your time to date. But are you broadly optimistic that apart from the behavioral changes we have to make ourselves as individuals and as societies, that the changes in technology, the rapid changes in technology, the likes of sensors that bring us information in real time, not just from the bottom of the ocean, but from space, as you know, big data, then the use of artificial intelligence as well as human intelligence to interpret that in intelligent ways, and cloud computing to do the maths at a rapid rate, mm-hmm. that the combination of all those technological changes give us a fighting chance?
Certainly they help. Let me just say a word or two quickly about the situation we're in. This crisis is not a natural disaster. It's an ecological disaster. It's rooted in humanity's relationship with the planet as a whole. Most of the illnesses like coronavirus, like COVID-19, are what are called zoonotic. They come from wildlife and they pass either directly or indirectly through livestock into humans. And if you want to monitor whether you want to look for these illnesses, you have to look at where human beings are changing the landscape, where we're cutting down forests to build pasture land for our animals or agriculture, and in the process changing the climate. So this is a subset of the global climate crisis. Two really quick points there. One is that according to the International Energy Agency, carbon emissions this year will drop by about 8% globally. That's profound. It also shows you how little our individual choices really matter, how much we have to really re-engineer the systems toward a brighter and cleaner and greener future. The UN has told us we have to reduce every year, year on year, by 8%, just what we've gone through now, for the next decade if we want to eliminate the worst effects of climate change. And the only way we're going to be able to effectuate that change, if we choose to do it, is using these advanced computational tools that help us figure out how to improve the efficiency of solar installations, how to get more value out of the energy systems that we already use. Google itself used its own artificial intelligence systems to improve the energy efficiency of its own data centers by 40%. And that kind of efficiency gain can be given to the broader world and help us on our way to a cleaner and brighter future.
It perhaps can help us in that way and encourage us to make the right decisions ourselves, but the information that it will provide will possibly scare us as well, as long as we believe it, that if we can see what's actually happening to ocean currents in real time and the predicted patterns that will happen over a very short period of time and their impact on us, and if we believe it, it may have as significant a behavioral change as encouragement.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, my day job is working with an amazing organization called Planet. We've deployed the largest constellation of Earth-observing satellites in history, and we image the whole planet every day in high resolution. Then we use the tools of artificial intelligence to characterize what we're seeing around the world. And we mostly use this for monitoring things like coral reefs and agriculture and deforestation to help target humanitarian assistance, and in many, many other areas. But one of the things we like to say about this, Vincent, is you can't fix what you can't see. Many of these challenges are not really salient for human beings because we don't encounter them on a daily basis. You don't see climate change walking down the street on a Thursday. You have to take a larger macroscopic view. But as soon as you do, it becomes obvious what to do. You know, as an example, we can see every act of deforestation happening through our satellites in the Amazon as it happens every day. But not only do we see the signs of change, the clear cutting, we lose 40 football pitches an hour to deforestation all the time. We've lost a number of them just as we've been talking here. While that's been occurring, and while we can see the deforestation, we can also see the illegal roads that go in just before the next round of deforestation occurs. We can see the pre-indicators of the next round of change. And that gives us a window to interdict and stop that behavior right at the point where it's likely to happen. And because we're doing this from space, we can see everywhere. So it's not like you can move all your assets and do that, you know, that act of illegal deforestation down the road somewhere, because we can see down the road. So these tools are going to be essential for creating accountability, for enabling us to pay for conservation, to allow us to pay for performance, to help help build the kinds of indicators that we can use to drive the economy in greener and cleaner and more sustainable directions. And what has happened now is that we have given residents of Delhi, India, and in China and across the world a glimpse of what a lower carbon, healthier future is. A team at Stanford University did this amazing analysis. They found that during the period of the peak COVID crisis, the first chapter of it in Wuhan, China lost something like 5,000 people, a little bit less, but around 5,000 people. A team at Stanford University estimated that during the same period, by clearing the skies and by shuttering the factories temporarily, the Chinese likely saved the lives of 4,000 children under 5 years old and 73,000 people over the age of 70 just by clearing the air, because air pollution is one of the most deadly factors for human morbidity. So we've given people this briefest glimpse, and it's been intensely painful and awful to get to, but we've given them a glimpse of what the future could be like. Now we expect that there will be political pressure and a kind of human yearning for that future that we can now use these technologies to help deliver.
Let's hope you're right. It's been a fascinating conversation. That's Andrew Zolli, Vice President of Global Impact at Planet and author of Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. Andrew, thanks a million for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. So follow us on Twitter for updates at TakingStockNT, and you'll find the podcast from Fridays at newstalk.com and the Newstalk app. My thanks to the production team of Simon Keane and Stephen Jordan. So from Taking Stock with me, Vincent Wall, take it easy.
Taking Stock on Newstalk.